Well, because I gave them to him yesterday.
Yeah, I've never gotten there.
You ready?
Jeff.
Okay. That makes me feel better.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you to the 10:30 session. This is what internet security providers need to know about the law. We have a repeat speaker, Jennifer Granick from San Francisco. She spoke last year at Black Hat on a variety of things. Some of her speaking experiences are Black Hat, NASA, and NSA. Since they're neighbors, I figured she went to both just because she didn't know how to spell them. But she had fun, I think. Her co-speaker is Mark L. Eckenweiler. I'm sorry if I butchered the name.
Close enough.
He's from the Department of Justice. He's going to be talking about the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. I'd invite you, if you need handouts, they're at the corner over there. Please feel free to ask questions. Please enjoy the session. Thank you.
Hello, world. As Jack says, my name is Mark Eckenweiler. I'm a senior counsel in the Computer Crime and Intellectual Property section with the Department of Justice. I do have to give you a disclaimer here at the beginning of this talk. Anything I say this morning represents my own personal views. These are not the official views of the Computer Crime and Intellectual Property section, the Criminal Division, the U.S. Department of Justice, the Executive Branch, the Federal Government, or Major League Baseball. Here, in a nutshell, is where I work and what I do, which is just about everything that impinges on federal criminal law and technology. My section, which is fairly small and probably a good thing for you guys in private industry, is getting smaller because a lot of us have left for private industry, works on everything legislation, policy, and the occasional investigation. Enough about me and what I do. What I want to talk about this morning is this somewhat obscure statute, obscure to some, less obscure to lawyers, called the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. And I think it's worth saying at the outset that the title for the this session, the 10:30 session, is a little bit of a misnomer, because this is a statute that applies not just to ISPs, providers to the public, but to anybody out there running a network. If you have two machines talking to each other, particularly if you're running some sort of email service, you are subject to this law, whether or not you know it. Pay attention, at least for the next couple of minutes here. Why you might care about the statute is that it is the comprehensive federal privacy framework for communications providers. And as I say, that's both public and non-public. It regulates conduct between and among users, their providers, and the government. And when I say government, I don't just mean law enforcement. I mean everybody, state regulatory investigators, the Federal Trade Commission, the Securities and Exchange Commission, applies to all of us. This is a statute that not only tells you what not to do, but puts some teeth into that. There are civil and criminal penalties for a variety of violations of different parts of the statute. And as we go through, I'll try and give you a flavor of what those look like. And one other caveat here, of course, I'm just going to talk about federal law. The states, in their infinite wisdom, have enacted a patchwork variety of laws. You know, almost every state has some sort of wiretap law. And while it can never go lower than the federal protections set a floor, in many cases, the states have engrafted additional protections onto federal law. So what I say is not the authoritative bottom line. This is just the authoritative bottom line as far as federal law goes. Why it matters to me and my colleagues is, of course, that we're seeing more and more folks coming onto the net. And it's not the way it was back in 1984 or so when I first started monkeying around on what was then the ARPANET. We now have lots of obviously legitimate activity on the net, but with legitimate activity comes all kinds of bad activity, and I probably don't have to tell you guys about that. ECPA is kind of stock in trade for us in my section, because it is the primary set of rules for when we can get records, when we're doing an investigation. This is what tells us what we can get or what we can't get and if we can get it, how that goes. So let me talk a little bit about this statute. Can I just see a show of hands? How many of you guys are actually lawyers? There are real lawyers here. Okay. I used to start these talks to mixed audiences by telling some sort of lawyer joke, but I stopped doing that because the lawyers in the audience never thought that they were funny, and the other people never thought they were jokes. So, and speaking of jokes, I just want to give you a sense of what the federal courts think of this statute. Steve Jackson Games, a case some of you may have heard of, the Fifth Circuit there, it's a federal appeals court that covers Texas and some adjacent states. Famous, if not infamous, for its lack of clarity, fraught with tripwires, that's not the capital T one word, tripwire. A fog of inclusions and exclusions. These are federal judges who find this stuff baffling, okay, trained lawyers. So if you find it a little non-intuitive at times, you're in very, very, very good company. The best way that I can take this impossibly confusing mass of law and try and put it into some sort of framework for people to wrap their heads around is to use this teaching tool that I refer to as the Matrix. I am not talking about Keanu Reeves and company. I'm talking about this. It's a 2x2 box, and as I go through this talk, what I'd like to do is fill in each of these boxes to describe what the rules are for law enforcement access to the particular kind of communication. So we've got across the top here real-time and historical information. Are these bits that are going to move in the future? Are we talking about things that are sitting on media somewhere, not going anywhere? And then, you know, on the other axis, we have contents, which is a defined term under the statute, and the other stuff. So if you want to think about that as sort of header-like information and payload, that's fine. If you want to think of that as people yakking on the phone, that's contents. The numbers that they dial to make the call go through, that would be non-content. So let's start with real-time acquisition of communications, also known in the statute as interception. Title III, and this all goes back to the original 1968 federal wiretap statute. It starts out with a general prohibition. Do not intercept communications that don't belong to you. And furthermore, if somebody has, could be you, could be somebody else, has intercepted communications that don't belong to them, the use or disclosure of the contents of those communications itself is a crime if the person who gets the information knows that it came from an illegal wiretap. So it doesn't just stop at the wiretapping itself. You can have ongoing sort of cumulative offenses. The statute applies, there are three different categories of communications. That's oral, two people sitting on a park bench, they think there's nobody around, but there's actually a guy with a parabolic mic up in a tree 20 yards away. That's an oral communication. People think they're having a private communication. Wire, that's voice over some sort of medium. It includes things like cell phone calls. And electronic is basically non-voice over some kind of technological medium. And as we go through, I'll try and describe some of the differences. You would think, why distinguish between wire and electronic? There was a decision that Congress made in 1986, I think in large part because at the time, members of Congress understood telephone calls, and in 1986, members of Congress and their staff were not sending email. Probably were not, they might have been sending faxes in 86, but probably weren't sending pager messages to each other. And so this electronic stuff was in some ways given, I don't want to call it second-class citizenship, but certainly the protections are a little bit lower under the statute. Now, if you violate this default rule, this thou shalt not intercept, there's a variety of penalties. The baseline is it's a 5-year felony maximum. Your actual sentence if you intercept stuff is determined under the sentencing guidelines. And even if you're not criminally prosecuted or in addition to a criminal prosecution, you can also have a private suit. Anybody who is an aggrieved party, like two people were talking on the phone, A was talking to B, and there was some interceptor, both A and B can sue the eavesdropper, get $10,000 at a minimum per violation, although the courts are kind of split on that. because a lot of these take place in divorce cases, and the courts just hate to, you know add insult to emotional injury. And as far as not just the government, but anybody goes, suppression. So if A and B have a conversation and C intercepts it and wants to, say, turns it over to law enforcement, the general rule is that even though law enforcement didn't have anything to do with that interception, it cannot be used as evidence. Let's say A and B were conspiring to commit a crime. Cannot be used against them. So this is a much broader statutory suppression rule than the Fourth Amendment. Fourth Amendment just says that the government did something bad. But this statute says if you have an intercepted wire communication that was illegally intercepted, nobody gets to use it. Can't be used in court, can't be used in, before a grand jury, nada. So in a way, this statute ups the ante for violations. Why am I talking about this at Black Hat? Well, part of the 1986 amendment, the idea behind that was to bring new technologies like email and BBSs, which of course were really novel to Congress in 1986, within the scope of the federal wiretap statute. There was a lot of question about some of these new technologies, cellular, cordless phones, and Congress said, we really need to bring all these things within the reach of this privacy framework. One of the implications of this is it is illegal to install an unauthorized sniffer on a packet switch network. And in a number of recent cases, we have in fact prosecuted people for hanging sniffers on networks. Now, I said it starts out in Title III with a general prohibition. But like most statutes that prohibit things, you have some exceptions. This is a place where Congress impressively anticipated that you might not want to make it a crime to intercept every possible electronic communication. They said if it's a publicly accessible system, and they had in mind then BBSs, but it would be applicable to things like chat rooms, it's okay. It's not a felony to lurk. And then these other exceptions here that I'll go through in order. Consent, system provider privileges, which you guys probably care about the most. Although I'm sure you've been doing monitoring in blissful ignorance of all these rules. And then court-authorized intercepts, what allows law enforcement to do data taps. So consent of a party. Consent under the statute does not have to be expressed. You don't have to have a piece of paper signed by the person that says, yes, you own everything I do on this network. That can be implied. That's why you guys have login banners, certainly those of you who work at companies that handle lots of proprietary information, or maybe government agencies, for those of you who in fact work in the public sector, login banners that say, forget about privacy here. You use this, we own you. Terms of service, employment agreement, we see this in a variety of contexts. And all of those are ways to take monitoring outside the prohibition. As long as you got the consent, and you only need consent of one party under the federal statute. You don't need everybody's consent. Some states require that. It's about a dozen or so. But under federal law, if one person who's a participant in the communication says it's okay, then that's it. You're done. The monitoring is lawful. One thing I want to say, by the way, as we go through here, I realize some of this stuff may be a little less than clear. So if you have questions, please ask. I'm sure you know, because you work in information technology, that there really is no such thing as a stupid question. There are stupid people asking questions. But so I have a question right here. Go ahead.
Sure, he's not one of them.
What if a person doesn't understand English? What is your definition for a banner to be seen by a person? Seen as his computer receives it, yet his computer doesn't process it or show it up on the screen. How can we prove that consent had been undertaken by this individual, foreign, domestic, whatever?
Well, yeah. Did everybody hear? Was there anyone who did not hear the question? All right. I think there are a number of different questions bound up in there. One is, does the person speak English or not? I don't know. I think they if they don't read the banner, it's sort of at their peril. There's some authority, not under the wiretap statute. I actually don't know anything of any cases at all wrestling with that particular problem. But certainly under contract law, if you sign something that you're sort of on notice that you really ought to pay attention, you ought to know what that says, you're stuck with it. You're bound by it, even if you didn't. If you had an opportunity to learn what it was saying, basically. Now, you also asked a question, it has not to do with sort of mental faculties, but rather, is it displayed in a way that nobody would ever see? So let's say that there's a banner, or, you know, I've got a banner on port 25, but no human being ever actually looks at port 25. The stuff just comes in from the mail servers talking to each other. I think that would be a harder case. So, you know, bannering things like port 23, I think it's a pretty fair argument to say there you've got consent. But in fact, we have some issues about the quality of consent when you've got things like high port exploits and whether or not, in fact, you can really infer consent from having hung a banner on a port that nobody's ever going to look at. But it's a good question, and it's one that we wrestle with. Of course, Congress never thought about this, you know, in any way. I mean, this is all new stuff for them. Was there another question back here?
Yeah, like we were talking about eavesdropping a little bit before. Having a Unix box that keeps that is on your segment to the view so that you can capture all packets and payloads, headers, and payloads, is that sort of against what you were talking about before?
Well, what I would say is having your Ethernet card in promiscuous mode, you're certainly engaging in interception, and the real inquiry then is that a permissible one or not? Okay. Well, let me walk through some of the other exceptions, and if I haven't satisfied that, then you know you can call me on it, and we'll come back to it. Let me move forward here, okay? If you can just hold other questions for a moment, because I think Jennifer does want to say a couple things at some point this morning. Now, one of the sort of corollaries to having consent through banners is that implied consent can give, and I say an ISP, I that's really sort of a misnomer, I really do mean a provider, authority to pass information on to law enforcement, or frankly, anybody else that the provider, you know, wants to pass it on to, you know, maybe the upstream. System operator privileges. This is a big one, particularly for you guys. And it was big. This goes back to the 1968 statute when the primary sort of clientele, if you will, was Ma Bell, the telco, now the telcos. A provider can monitor real-time communications to protect its rights or property. Now, so that means, you know, like keystroking, if you've got some sort of anomaly and you start keystroking the hell out of you know, some box where you think you've got an intruder. This actually has been construed very, very broadly by the courts. There's one case I can think of in which a hotel operator eavesdropped on an incoming call to a room in the hotel. You know, she naturally had to listen to the first second or two to make sure the call had gone through, but she stayed on the line because the guest in the room sounded emotionally distraught, and as the operator listened, she found out that the folks in this room had passed a counterfeit 20 to a pizza delivery man. Now, I think one might fairly question, you know, So what if they did? How does that impair the rights or property of the hotel? But the Fifth Circuit, this same federal appeals court down in Texas, had no problem saying, well, there was sort of bad activity afoot, therefore we're going to let that one ride. That was a permissible overhearing. The operator could listen in. I think what that means for folks in the IT industry, and certainly in a packet-switched environment, is if you can show any sort of reason at all to want to be monitoring, and frankly, you can do this proactively. I say here, phone companies are more restricted than ISPs. The phone company can't listen to all the calls against the possibility that they're going to find some phone freaker. But that's only a restriction on phone companies, providers of wire communication. If it's electronic stuff, you can monitor proactively to make sure in advance that nobody is hacking your network. So, in fact, this is a very, very broad set of authorities for system operators. And I think this may answer your question here, the one about having a machine in promiscuous mode. The same subsection also says The provider can intercept communications if it is inherently necessary to providing the service. Give you the example of AOL. AOL has however many mail servers that it has. When somebody from, MCI Internet sends an email to an AOL subscriber, the AOL mail server intercepts, within the meaning of the statute, that communication. Fortunately for the provider, it's not a felony because that's part of the service that they're providing. So Congress has carved that stuff out. And to the same extent, if something that goes along with providing the service or administering the network, then it's okay to have your box in promiscuous mode. But that does not mean that the sky is the limit. You'd want to be the provider. You'd actually want to be the person owning or operating the system in order to seek shelter within this exception. Yeah?
Once a client has been identified, law enforcement has been contacted, can the provider still monitor real-time communications and hand that over on its own volition to law enforcement without violating any privacy?
This is a very, very, very good question. Our position has been that this exception right here, actually, I think I may deal with this on the next slide. Nope, I lied. Our position has been this is an exception that is for the benefit of the provider. I can cite to you that there's exactly one court case I can think of that's sort of on point. A police officer, I think this was in Chicago, had identified someone as a criminal suspect, knew the guy was using a clone phone, went to the cell phone provider, in whose system the phone had been cloned, and said, listen, I would like for you to monitor the communications of this person. And the cell phone company, knowing this was not their legitimate subscriber, said, yeah, sure, we'll do that. Various things happened after that. The guy was never criminally prosecuted for reasons that aren't set forth in the opinion. But what happened is the guy's name was McClelland, who had the clone phone, turned around and sued the police officer. I think he might have sued the cell phone company, too. The first footnote in the opinion is the definition of chutzpah. But get this. This is the interesting thing about the case. What happened there was the police officer, Officer McGrath, moved to basically throw out this suit for civil damages. He said, this is outrageous. You had this guy here. He had no business being in that system. He had cloned the phone. He was ripping them off. You got to throw this out. It was not illegal to intercept those. And the district court, as a federal district court, said, well, this really was undertaken for sort of a different purpose. You had an agency relationship there between the provider and law enforcement. And the court was not comfortable enough with that to throw the claim out. So, in fact, incredibly, the civil claim went forward. Our position has been, this right here is for providers. This lets providers do whatever it is they're authorized to do, before, after, during, law enforcement's being involved. But our position has been that once we show up, you call law enforcement, and I don't know, maybe this is where your question is coming from. You may have had this experience. But once we show up, launch an investigation, we, except potentially for a brief period before we can get a court wiretap order, we will not rely on this. The way we describe it is we don't water ski behind this exception. Our view is that's for providers. It's not there for law enforcement. So we would, we might look to you for consent. Maybe you've got a banner up. In that case, we might do monitor. We might receive the fruits of future monitoring that you do. But our view is that that exception does not give us a green light to do monitoring in conjunction with the provider. Let me, I know there are a lot of questions. Let me see, we're going to have time at the end, I think, for questions, I hope. So,
you have 18 minutes.
Okay, I have 18 minutes. I'm gonna keep going then, and I will stick around for questions after this, of course. All right, court-authorized monitoring. When we want to do monitoring, and we can't rely on something like consent, we have to go get what we call a Title III or a T3. somewhat confusingly. This is good for 30 days maximum. We have to show various things. These are required both under the Constitution and the statute, things like necessity, you know, lesser means have been attempted and failed or would be too dangerous. Minimization, we're only allowed to intercept certain things that relate to the offense. So let's say we're tapping a phone line, and that's the phone into the home, and it turns out that little Johnny also calls Granny to thank her for the cookies from time to time. We're not allowed to tape record that. You can listen long enough to figure out that it's Johnny calling Granny, and then you have to turn off the tape recorder. These other requirements, 10-day reporting and sealing, just more stuff that we have to do under the supervision of the court. As I mentioned before, some of the ways that this may show up in the computer network environment is keystroking. See this particularly in network intrusion cases. Cloning an email account. If all we're interested in is somebody's email, let's say that we happen to think they're conspiring with other folks, and you know, we want to see what's being said. This is just like a telephone tap, only we would use this instead to obtain, you know, inbound and outbound email directed to or from that account. So there's the first box in our matrix. The rule, if I want to get authority from the court, I need what's called the Title III order, or I can do it under consent if there's legitimate consent. And just there being a banner in and of itself doesn't do it. The banner has to say the right things. Like, you don't want the banner to say all information stored on this network is subject to disclosure, because that's information stored. That's not information being transmitted. Okay, real-time transactional records. This one's pretty brief. We've had since 1986 something called the Federal PIN Register and Trap and Trace Statute, and of course in the telephone context, that's either numbers dialed or the source of an incoming call. PIN register for outbound, trap and trace for inbound, and it's our position that that applies equally in the computer network context. So we can use this to gather things that are not content, things like addresses on in or outbound email, not subject headers, that would be contents, that's Title III territory. You know, pick a protocol, you know, pick a port. It could be inbound FTP connections to an FTP server. It might be where a user is logging in from. You know, we want to see, I've worked some fugitive cases where you want to see, is the guy coming in on a dial-up, is he coming in across the network? Yeah, question?
Sorry, it sounds like
I'm sorry?
What, it sounds like you can collect much more than you can use in court. What happens to that information that you collect?
Well, what we collect is what we're allowed to collect under the statute, under the authority of, say, a court order, like a pen register, a trap and trace. So, you know, once you collect it under the authority of the court order, you're allowed to use that for any legitimate law investigative purpose. Here, I'm not talking about content here. Remember, this is transactional records. This is not the substance of communications. We're talking about things like IP address, port, the urgent bit, stuff like that.
But you said that an ISP can collect the information. Once they've collected it, then law enforcement can get access to that user, correct? The law enforcement can't ask for it to be collected.
Let me get to the rules about sort of historically stored stuff in a little bit. I think I may answer your question as we go forward, as I fill out some of the other boxes in the matrix. Okay, so for real time gathering prospectively stuff that is not contents, but is, you know, let's call it metadata. PIN register or trap and trace statute, or again, consent, solves everything under these statutes. And then we have the other great divide. We have the stored communications and historical records provisions of the statute, which is just chock full of dichotomies, permissive versus mandatory disclosure. Content, it's not all treated the same. Some content is more equal than other content. The basic rule under this this set of provisions, this is for the law geeks among you, Chapter 121 of Title 18 of the U.S. Code, content gets more protection than non-content. All right. Let's again talk here about what happens if this gets violated. There are civil remedies. It's not the $10,000, it's $1,000 minimum per violation. Attorney's fees may be available. Criminal remedies. User A breaks into user B's email inbox, reads his unread email, or let's say unaccessed email sitting on the POP server. That's a federal crime, although currently it's just a misdemeanor. And even if it's undertaken for, say, financial gain, that's still just a misdemeanor of maximum penalty 1 year. This does not apply to the provider. My last line here, the statute says providers can't break this law. And the flip side of that is, in fact, a system provider under this statute, just looking at this in a vacuum, not looking at any other state laws or contractual agreements with the user, a system provider can read any damn thing it wants stored on its own system. And there's actual case law on that. We have this case here from Nevada, of all places. So no prohibition under federal law. You can vary that by contract. I promise not to read my user's email unless I have a good reason. But note, this is read. This is not give to other people. That's different. So let's talk about public providers and permissive disclosure here. AOL, an email provider, Verizon, my ILEC, who might say provide voicemail services to me, cannot, as a general rule, freely disclose customer content to other people. I mean, there are some exceptions here, consent as usual, that same rights or property exception. If they inadvertently discover it and it pertains to the commission of a crime, they can turn it over to law enforcement. This does not mean that they can sort of deputize themselves and just start groveling through everything in the mail spool. And if they happen to find the word murder or kidnap or whatever, then they can turn that over. I would say that's not inadvertent acquisition. And Congress clearly intended for, in those circumstances, for the provider not to be permitted to turn that over, only if they stumble across it. Now, that was permissive disclosure. And by the way, if you're not a public provider, you can do whatever you want, not just read, but you can disclose. So for those of you who are not ISPs, you just work in the corporate environment, you can turn around, you can give it to the Wall Street Journal, and it's not a violation of the statute. There's actually a case involving disclosure to the Wall Street Journal. It was a, I'll call it a lawsuit, but it was really sort of a pissing match between Arthur Anderson and a company in Illinois. Arthur Anderson had been sacked as a consultant. The company was aggrieved about the way this this whole thing had played out. And so they took some very embarrassing emails that had been left behind by the Arthur Anderson consultants and handed them over to the Wall Street Journal, which published them. Arthur Anderson sued. The district court, I think rightly, said, sorry, not a public provider. They could do whatever they wanted with that information. So the rules are very different if you're, you know, Earthlink, Mindspring, AOL, you know, Microsoft Network, versus just plain old corporation not providing service to the public. Now let's say we're not talking about permissive. And let's go to the other, this is the other half of what I think is, this is basically a four space here. Putting aside permissive disclosure, mandatory disclosure, how can I, as law enforcement, require somebody to produce to me the contents of email stored on a system? If it is, this shows the age of this statute. Congress basically said if it's 6 months old or less, we have to use a search warrant. So that's full probable cause. It operates like a subpoena. I would go to the provider and say, not stand back from the keyboard, I'm going to take it off your system. I serve you the piece of paper, and you, as the provider, are obliged to produce within you know, a reasonable time the requested records. So prior to 1986, I could have just used a grand jury subpoena. Didn't have to show probable cause. So Congress substantially raised the bar on this 14 years ago. For other stuff, and this is, it's kind of an interesting distinction, Congress says for opened email, other stored files, say, you know, things are sitting in a home directory, they're not going anywhere, you know, they have no additional destination in the way that, say, mail sitting on a POP server is waiting to be downloaded to, say, an end-user device. I can use just a subpoena. Although there is this sort of interesting notice requirement. I have to give notice except when I don't, and I can justify to the court there are various bases for delaying notice, although ultimately notice has to be given. This doesn't apply at all to non-public providers. I can choose a straight subpoena. Yeah?
I have a records destruction schedule in my corporation. probation.
Mm-hmm.
You file a subpoena on me for information. If I'm following my destruction schedule, and I don't have that information, what can be done?
Do you mean you have destroyed the records prior to receiving service of the subpoena?
Destruction that these corporations have on the records.
Sure, sure.
And is that held electronic?
Here's the answer. If a subpoena is served on you calling for the production of certain records, once you get that and can sort of reasonably take steps within your organization to secure those records for production to the compelling agency, you got to turn it over, whatever it is. It could be on... No, let me just walk through. If it's on paper, if it's electronic, whatever. But you can only produce what you have. If you destroyed that stuff 2 days ago, then you can't very well produce it, I think. And nothing is going to happen to you. So the real problem is, let's say you get the subpoena and 3 days later you cycle out the records. You know, your logs are it's sort of a FIFO, and you cycle them out every 7 days. Then you could have a problem because your organization has been given a legal process requiring it to produce this stuff. And if you don't take steps to secure it thereafter, and to produce it in response to the subpoena, then you can have a problem. But if you destroyed it in the past before getting the subpoena, nothing's going to happen to you.
I get like 5 minutes.
Okay. All right, so that is the third box in our matrix. And you notice I've subdivided it here, unopened email, unaccessed email, really. For that, law enforcement must use a warrant. For other stored content, remember, we're in the content half here, I can use a lesser process, something like a subpoena. There is a notice requirement, although I wouldn't say it's the firmest notice requirement. Notice must ultimately be given. It's not always in advance. And then let's talk about the last part of the box, the stuff that's not content and it's not track and trace things. This is not future. Just hold that until the end, if you will. Not future metadata, but past metadata. The rule is short and sweet. Providers, anybody, public, private, can disclose these to anybody on earth except the government. The government needs either appropriate legal process or consent. And let's talk a little bit about the categories and the process applicable to each. There are two different halves here. One is what folks in my section call basic subscriber information, and then we have transactional records. Basic subscriber information, I can use a regular old grand jury trial subpoena, FTC administrative subpoena, SEC administrative subpoena. In response to a subpoena, provider must give the government these things. These are enumerated in the statute. And you have those in the handout. The everything else category, stuff that's not content and not those things on that list that I just showed you, basic subscriber info. So things like the user logs, you know, when did the person log in, how long is he logged in for, if you're doing dynamic IP allocation, you know, what IP address was allocated to that account for that session. It would include things like, you know, at the application level, things like the addresses to which email had been sent in the past. Again, this is all historical. We're not talking future information gathering. This is merely records currently held relating to past activity. For this stuff, I use what's called a Section 2703D court order. Those of you who went to the attrition.org talk yesterday might have heard the glancing reference to this. It's called that because that's just the section of the code that describes what it is. It looks kind of like a search warrant in that I have to tell a story to the court. I have to describe why it is that this stuff is relevant to my investigation, and I can't just sort of say, trust me on it. I have to give specific and articulable facts. This actually came in through students of legal history. This was something that was put in 1994 as part of CALEA. It is a lower standard than probable cause, but it does require a lot more paper, actually going before a judge and basically justifying the requirement that the stuff be produced. So as I say, judicial oversight and fact-finding. And there's the last box in the matrix. How am I doing for time, Jennifer?
You're great. You have 3 minutes.
I have 3 minutes. Okay. I've got a little more to go here. This is just a different way of thinking about the kinds of process, looking at it from a top-down sort of perspective. A warrant, basically I can use a warrant to compel the production of anything. This D order I can use for transactional records. I can actually also use that for things like opened email and files. Subpoena, as I said, that's for certain kinds of historical content, basically everything except unopened email, and the basic subscriber info. So how this works out in practice, now that your minds are well-numbed, suppose we get a threat, some sort of report that a threat email came from ISP.com, and let's do this modulo spoofing, okay? Forget about header spoofing. Let's say that the headers are, in fact, kosher. If we want to find out the actual, or I shouldn't say the actual, but the registered real-world name of this user at ISP.com, we serve on ISP.com a subpoena. If we want to find out, now let's just make sure this person was in fact logged in at the time that the email was purportedly sent. Let's nail it down. Let's see where it came in from. Was this across the net? Somebody telnet in, SSH in, or was this a dial-up? For that, I use a so-called D order, Section 2703D, specific and articulable facts court order. And if I want to get all the email sitting in Stalk and News account, let's make this simple, say it's a shell account, then I would have to use a Rule 41 warrant based on probable cause. And as I say, all of these things are, I give paper on the provider. The provider is the third party, just sort of a custodian of records, just like, the telco was the intermediary back in 1968 when the wiretap statute was first passed. I do not kick in the door. I say, here is some paper. This describes what you need to produce to me. There's actually an opportunity to contest. Some providers do on occasion contest these things. It works in the way that a subpoena normally does, even if it happens to be a warrant. Preclusion of notice. One of the things that Congress has said we can do when we serve any one of these flavors of process on a provider is we can ask the court to direct the provider not to tell the customer or subscriber. And that's actually fairly routine because it does tend to impair the effectiveness of a criminal investigation if your target knows that the investigation is ongoing. That's particularly true in wiretap cases. You'd be surprised how little people will use a certain communications medium if they know that it's being wiretapped.
That was
one other thing that you may see if you have contact with law enforcement or other government agencies are these so-called F letters. It's subsection F of Section 2703. 2703 is where all these bodies are buried. If some of you want to see it, you can just call this up. You go to Cornell, go to the House.gov. That's one of the reasons I put the sites in here. And these are all readily accessible federal statutes. F says, if I want to ask you to preserve something that you have right now, like the records that you may be cycling out, under your record retention policy, you're going to delete those in 3 days. I can say to you, whatever it is that I've just specified, content, non-content, it could be login records, it could be contents of email, I want you to preserve that. Do not give it to me, because I didn't give you a court order. I didn't give you a warrant. I haven't given you anything except a please. So this is not legal process in the sense of you need to give to me within the specified time the specified records. This is just hang on to them so that they are not destroyed either by you or anybody else with access like the subscriber. Key concept here, does not apply prospectively. I cannot give you a letter and say, for the next 90 days, please collect all of your user, user John Doe, collect all of his email and wrap it up with a nice big bow and give it to me. That would be a wiretap. And if I didn't, let's put it this way. If one did not have some sort of authority, like a Title III court order to do a wiretap, that would be wrong. So at least wrong for me to direct you to do. So if I want to receive that stuff that you preserve, I still have to go back, look in the matrix, what are the records? If it's login records, then it's going to be the D order, and so on down the line. In closing, what I want to say is, you know, whether you're a public provider, whether you're an ISP, or whether you're just a regular old company, believe it or not, all these statutes do in fact apply to you, and it does make some sense to have at least a passing familiarity with what the requirements are, particularly because we are certainly seeing an increasing number of cases where we are going not just to public providers, but also to corporate networks to seek information that's related to criminal investigations. And if you understand how this stuff works, and frankly, if the law enforcement, I mean, much of my job is trying to train law enforcement to do this stuff right, it makes these relations go a whole lot smoother. It gets us out of your hair. The last thing we want to do is gum up your jobs, gum up your business. I mean, we have a job to do, and the sooner that we can get the things that we need and are authorized to get under the statute and get out of the way, I think the better off everybody is. Places to go. Here's the phone number. You know, if you feel like chatting with a federal prosecutor, you know, you can call this number. We do have a website, cybercrime.gov. And that's pretty much it. I'm actually, right now, because I know I've run a little bit old over, I'm just going to shut up right now. And I will.
Set up, so if you want to take a break.
Okay. I will not shut up. Jennifer has directed me not to shut up. There's a question there way in the back. Well, you have to do a disclaimer. You're an attorney, aren't you?
No.
Okay. All right. Somebody's got to be.
Under the permission of disclosure, you were saying that you give it to anyone except a governmental entity. Is that
permissive disclosure of non-content records? So like who John Doe really is, how often he's logged on, not the contents of his email. For permissive disclosure of contents, you have to look to see whether it's a private or public provider. No, it says governmental entity. To anyone except a governmental entity is the way it's phrased. It's an interesting question. I don't think there's any authority on that. Yeah, Lou.
In the request to preserve, it's a plea.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when somebody says no?
If somebody says no, that's an interesting question. I don't think it's ever been resolved. I have aggressive colleagues who would like to pursue cases. Did everybody hear the question? Were there people who did not hear the question? This is on F letters. What happens if there's no compliance? Some people think you could actually pursue the provider for obstruction of justice. That seems pretty draconian to me, but I think it would vary based on the facts and why the refusal is given. There's another theory that you could the government could sue the provider under the statute for civil remedies, including declaratory and injunctive relief. But it really hasn't been tested. We try to keep fairly decent relations with the provider community, and so we have not run into this by and large. Yeah.
Can you talk about one point? Are providers able to look at the emails of their employees or monitor the telephone conversation with employees without consent?
Okay, when you say can employers look at the emails of their employees, are you talking about sort of some sort of proactive system where you are watching everything as it comes in? Let's say you're cloning it all off to some separate inbox. Or are you talking about just going into the mail spool and looking at the stuff sitting on the media? Because it's a critical distinction under the statute. The answer is, if it is stuff sitting on media, not moving, if you will, you can do whatever you want in terms of reading it. Disclosure is a different thing. And in terms of intercepting, the stuff is coming in. We're talking about future collection of content. Then we go back to things like the rights or property exception. In the telephone world, there's also this funny thing called the business extension exception, which basically says if it's part of your regular business practice, it was to sort of allow companies to do things like listen into customer service reps, for instance. Although these days, my experience has been you call up, you're on hold for 25 minutes, finally you get someone, but there's a recording that says, be aware, they actually get my consent as one of the parties to the communication. So fairly broad latitude for the provider to access content, static or in transit, on a system. There are some limits on it, particularly on overhearing telephone calls. Some of the courts have been unwilling to stomach total carte blanche on that. But it's fairly broad latitude. Are you ready to go? Okay. I'm sorry. I know there are more questions. I do promise to stay and answer questions, but Jennifer gets to talk too. Thanks very much for your attention.
Jennifer Granick. I'm a criminal defense attorney in San Francisco. Usually I deal with criminal issues, and also usually Mark deals with criminal issues, though we're usually on the opposite side. Today I'm going to talk about something that's a little bit outside of my usual area. I'm going to talk about the civil law and how civil law applies to people who run ISPs, websites, chat rooms, anything that any kind of mail server, anything like that. So I'm just going to run through some civil law issues. I wanted to spend about a half an hour on it, but I'm going to try to cut it short and end at 11:45 so that we have about 15 minutes for questions, because I am going to cover a lot of ground, and people seem really interested and confused by the ECPA and probably have a lot more questions for Mark about exactly how it works. I, for one, have some questions about it as well. And eventually, sooner or later, I just want to point out they do come and kick down your door. So they may not at first. They come smiling with the warrant in hand, but eventually there's some door kicking that does go on. Here's what I'm going to cover today. Defamation is when you say something bad about somebody, not an opinion, but a fact. I say that somebody committed a crime, somebody has venereal disease, that's a common one, and then the person's reputation is damaged, they want to sue. This comes up a lot when you're providing a communications medium for people. I'm going to talk about intellectual property really quick, just copyright and trademark. Copyright we all know a lot about. Everybody knows what happened to poor Napster this morning, right? So Napster got slammed because they allowed a medium in which copyrighted materials could be freely traded. We have copyright problems with posting of photographs, of stories, of trading of MP3s, software piracy, so copyright's a big deal these days. Trademark, mostly it comes up in the domain name circumstance, and I'm going to talk some about that. Obscenity and child pornography, things that you definitely want to not have on your network, if at all possible. And I'm going to talk about what under what circumstances a communications provider would be liable for these types of illegal materials which may be stored on their system. And finally, I'm going to talk a little bit about upstream liability in the case of security breaches. So these are the topics that I'm going to cover. So if I could have the next slide, please. I want to thank my volunteer who was commissioned by me and assisting me with my ancient technology of the overhead slides. I still haven't decided that I would like to use PowerPoint yet. So it seems like the technology works better now than it did initially when I decided never to use PowerPoint. Maybe I should change. Defamation. The elements of defamation are defamatory statement of fact, not opinion. And it has to be something which tends to injure the reputation of the plaintiff, which is published by the defendant. And by published, I don't just mean written communication. You're just even speaking like this is publication for defamation purposes, and from which damages occur. So there is some gloss to this basic definition of the defamation tort, which comes to the United States by way of the First Amendment, which gives us a lot of more freedom in the things that we might say as a constitutional matter. And that basically, if I can go over this very quickly, means that if it's a public official, for it to be defamation, you have to know that what you're saying about the public official is false, or you have to be recklessly disregarding the possibility that it's false. If it's a private person, but you're talking about a matter of public concern, there still must be actual malice. In other words, that you know what you're saying is false, or that you should know that it's false. And you have to have proof that actual injury resulted. And finally, if there's a private person and a matter of private concern, no real fault is required. And damages are presumed if it's a libel or slander per se, something that the law assumes by its very nature is damaging to the reputation. And I gave two examples earlier. Accusation that somebody committed a crime is classic per se, and accusation that somebody has a social disease or STD is also a classic per se. He asked me if the information is true. Truth is an absolute defense to defamation, so it has to be false.
In the U.S.
In the United States. That's not the case in Britain, for example. You may remember the McDonald's case where people were prosecuted there for some very negative things that they said about McDonald's. It doesn't really matter as much there. Another example of that is Texas has several anti-food disparagement laws, one of which Oprah Winfrey ran afoul of, and she went to trial down there in Texas for some nasty things she said about the beef industry. Fortunately, at least for Oprah, the First Amendment still works somewhat, even in Texas. So why is defamation important? It comes up in the area for ISPs under because it's basically a communications medium, whether it's something like a bulletin board system where people post messages, whether you host user websites and people may have something on their website that defames another person or insults another person, in real-time chat or flame wars where people get into fights, they say nasty things about each other, and there it is either being transmitted across your system or archived on your system for later generations to find. There's many opportunities for defamatory statements to be made. And so the question is, what is the responsibility of the ISP or the service provider when it comes to these defamatory statements? Initially, we had a lot of legal confusion over this. Pre-1996, we had two cases that came to sort of opposing ideas. One was Stratton Oakmont versus Prodigy. And in that case, the court held that because Prodigy exercised editorial control over their bulletin board system, they were like an editor and were responsible as a publisher for any defamatory statements that were contained on that system. This was sort of a slap at Prodigy. Here they were trying to make a family-oriented bulletin board system, and by virtue of their trying, they incurred liability for the statements that everybody on the system made. Another case was Cubby versus CompuServe. In that case, the court basically said that there was liability for defamatory statements only if CompuServe knew or should have known that the defamatory comments were on their system. And what happened was the United States Congress and the lobbyists of AOL and other big ISPs took a look at this and said, well, this isn't right. I mean, we may want to have this. First of all, it discourages people from editing content to make something family-oriented. It's just going to encourage people, or rather ISPs, to just let it be a free-for-all where anybody can write anything they want, and there'll be no trying to keep it nice for children. So, of course, once you put children in the mix, the United States Congress is very concerned, and they passed the Communications Decency Act. Now, a good portion of the Communications Decency Act was struck down as unconstitutional, and I'll be talking about that a little bit more when I deal with the obscenity thing, but some of the provisions still apply, and one of them is 47 U.S.C. Section 230C. This is the Good Samaritan provision. There's no civil liability on the account of any action taken voluntarily or in good faith to restrict access to or availability of online material that the user or provider considers to be objectionable. So if I'm going to be like Prodigy and make it a family-oriented thing, I'm not going to incur liability for trying to, you know, exercise an editorial control. It also completely immunizes an ISP for defamatory statements that are placed on it by a third party so long as the ISP was not involved in creating or editing the content. Okay. This will apply most probably to state law tort claims, not just to something that arises under federal law. It probably preempts state law tort claims, but it does not apply to criminal law or intellectual property law. intellectual property violations. So this is not an exception for businesses that have copyrighted material illegally posted on their site. So this is a statutory immunity, and we've seen it in effect most notably in the Sidney Blumenthal versus Matt Drudge case. In that case, Matt Drudge wrote on his column that Sidney Blumenthal beat his wife, and that turned out to be false, and Matt Drudge apologized, but Mr. Blumenthal was not appeased, and he sued Mr. Drudge and AOL because AOL had a forum on its site to present Mr. Drudge's column. AOL got out of that case using the statutory provision of 230C. Who is it? It's his mother. Using the statutory provision of 230C to get out of that case. Mr. Drudge, as far as I know, is still on the hook. Another case was the Zarin versus AOL case, which just simply confirmed what we already know by the statutory immunity. Even though AOL had noticed that defamatory messages were left on its site, and it did not, and it may have been negligent in not quickly removing or blocking access to those messages, it was not liable. It was immune from civil suit, not liable for the tort of defamation. Next slide, please. That's everything you need to know about defamation in about 5 minutes. Intellectual property violations. This is a big deal right now, as you know. It's in the news all the time, and one of the main issues is copyright law. Copyright law is basically the right to prevent other people from reproducing, writing derivative works, or copying, or selling, or displaying something that you wrote. It gives the rights of that to the artist. And basically, the definition of a work that is protected requires two things. First of all, it has to be original. And originality means not that it's the only one of its kind, but that in the way that it's expressed, the artist was the original person to express it that way. It is a protection of expression, not of ideas or of facts. And that's a complicated area in which there's many, 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 many cases interpreting exactly what that means. It also must be fixed. And the requirement of fixation means it can't just be an idea in your head. It has to be fixed into some tangible medium. Paper counts, code counts too. So once you have a copyrighted work, the person who owns the copyright has the right to reproduce it. It has the right to distribute it. He has the right to display it publicly. And he has the right to create derivative works that use or build upon that work. A great example of derivative works is fan fiction, where people will write stories that use the characters from, for example, X-Files or Star Trek or something like that to make up their own new stories. Now, I don't know if anybody in here does fan fiction or anything like that, but the internet's really been a boon to it, and a lot of copyright holders, Paramount and Viacom and Lucas and people who own the rights and these characters that people feel very close to, like from Star Wars and Star Trek, have cracked down on fan fiction because it's a violation of the right to prepare or produce a derivative work. Now for ISP, or a service provider, there's a couple ways you can infringe the copyright. There can be direct infringement, which is where the ISP actually has the copyrighted materials. The ISP or the server, whatever it is, actually has the copyrighted materials on its system. I have a case exactly like this. The copyrighted materials were proprietary software, and somebody was managing a system on which proprietary software would be posted for people to freely download. That is a direct infringement and directly a violation of both the civil and the criminal law. There's contributory infringement, which means that you cause or contribute to a third party's infringing conduct with knowledge of the infringing conduct. And this is the Napster problem. And then finally, there's vicarious liability, which is where you, the defendant, have the right and ability to control the infringing third party's acts. You receive a direct financial benefit from the infringing acts, and then in that case, you can be sued, but there is no actual knowledge of the infringing. You don't have to know that the infringement's going on. So basically what it means is you're not permitted, even if you don't know and you're an innocent party, you're not permitted to benefit financially from some third party's infringing acts if you have the right to control that party. So there's special issues when it comes to online stuff. What about caching? Caching is, by its very definition, copying. Caching is copyright violation. Well, it's not a copyright violation, but it is a copying of a it's an unauthorized copy of a copyrighted work. Framing is an issue where you take somebody else's content and put it in your background with your ad banners and your logos and your designs. Framing is a copyright problem. Linking may be a similar type of problem to framing. There's software piracy, which I discussed a little bit in connection with my case. And MP3s, which is, we all read the newspaper this morning, we know what that's about. And finally, user storage. So you may be provide a service where your users have some sort of storage space that they're permitted to have. It may be a company that's for the purpose of storage, like iDrive or xDrive or something like that. Or people may have it in their accounts, and in there they've got copyrighted material. So what are you going to do? Before October of 1998, the basic law was that if the ISP or service provider was informed of infringing acts, then they would have to terminate the infringer's access, or they could possibly face a claim of contributory infringement because they had knowledge. They were on notice. The person whose copyright was being violated had told them. The problem with this was that ISPs faced lawsuits from the accused person if they were if their access was wrongly terminated. There was no standard of proof. Nobody knew, did it just require a complaint, or did there have to be documentation before the third party could be terminated? And some ISPs just threw up their hands and said, well, I'm just going to let the victim, the copyright holder, and the infringer work it out. I'm not going to be involved at all. And in that circumstance, where the infringer was anonymous for some reason, the copyright holder was sort of SOL. So, next one, please. Thank you. So then we got the United States Congress stepped into the act with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And I'm going to talk a little bit just about a couple of provisions of this. This is a very big, very complicated statute with lots and lots of provisions. So this is sort of a gloss. And if you're going to rely on any of these things, I recommend you go and look at the actual sites and talk to an actual lawyer about this, because it's difficult. But basically, under the DMCA, there's a safe harbor provision which provides immunity to ISPs for contributory copyright infringement if the ISP meets the DMCA requirements. That is that the ISP has to post a warning to customers that their service will be terminated for repeat copyright offenses, and the ISP has to designate an agent to receive notifications of claimed infringements from copyright holder victims. It also expressly states, and that's the safe harbor provision, that's what you need to do, and if ISPs do that, you get statutory immunity. The statute also expressly states that caching and RAM copies are not infringing copies. So that's nice to know, because we were all worried about that. It limits liability for unwittingly linking to sites containing infringing materials or for storing infringing materials, which is good for companies like iDrive or xDrive, because now if somebody's got something on their storage area, the company's not responsible. Why are Napster and MP3 still in trouble? Well, Napster's problem is that it provides a service that facilitates the transfer of copyrighted files. And one of their biggest problems, I think, is everything that it said on their website and the way that the service was advertised, because it made it pretty clear that they knew that people were using the service to get copyrighted works by major artists for free. And I think that kind of rubbed Judge Patel the wrong way. MP3.com, they don't permit they have a system to try to make sure that it's authorized, but basically the reason they're in trouble is because what they did is they bought a bunch of CDs, copied it to their server, and then if users meet the authentication requirement of showing that they own a copy of the CD, then they can access the unauthorized copies on MP3's server. So that's why MP3 is in trouble. It's not even so much because they're providing music to users, it's because they made unauthorized copies of their CD library and put it on their server in the first place. So the final thing I want to say about the DMCA is that it gives the copyright owner subpoena power to learn the identity of the client of the ISP, which is responsible for the infringing act. So basically what that means is it has some recourse to learn the identity of an otherwise anonymous infringer. Question?
Copies, you did not distribute them, kept them for your own use, that's where it leads you.
So the question is, if I make copies, if I buy something and I have the right to have that, and I make copies and keep them for my own use, is that a copyright violation? And are you asking me this in relation to MP3?
Yes, I am.
Well, MP3 didn't keep it for their own use. MP3 sold it commercially to other people. That's why they got in trouble for their unauthorized copying. But otherwise, I think you're right. You buy a CD and you make a tape so that you can listen to it in your car. You're okay, as long as you're not giving it out to your friends and everything. The MP3 sold it to users, whereas the user can make their own copy. Okay, let me move on then, if I can have the next slide, please. Thank you. To trademark infringement. I'm just going to go really quickly through this. Mostly we're talking about domain names, and I'm not going to go through the Dilution Act, but you can take a look at this, and I think I provided this in the materials. Trademark dilution is a relatively new concept, which basically protects the goodwill or good name of a famous mark. I personally am very much against trademark dilution. I think it tends to impede free speech to an unprecedented and undesirable extent. But I just want to go on to the ISP part, which is, if I could have the next slide, please. The problem most often comes when I own the domain name apple.com or potatochips.com or something like that, and then the owner, Apple or whatever, wants it. But what if I'm Apple Cleaners? I mean, I have a right to that name, right? I just got there first. So all these companies are battling it out over domain names because there's only one apple.com, at least so far under the way ICANN's got it set up. So finally, to sort of deal with some of these problems, Congress passed the Anti-Cyber Squatting Consumer Protection Act, which is at 15 U.S.C. 1125. Basically, it makes it illegal to cyber squat. It makes it illegal to register, traffic, possess a domain name that is identical or confusingly similar to a distinctive or famous trademark, which was so at the time that the mark was registered. If it becomes famous later on, you're not in trouble. The biggest issue about this is, so you've registered the mark, you had the bad faith intent to profit from the mark, and if you have that, then the true owner of the mark, the rightful trademark owner, has the right to get the domain name back from you and also to sue you. And the best thing about it that domain name, or rather trademark owners like, is that it lets you do an in rem civil action against the domain name itself. And what that means is you don't have to sue the person or get money. You can sue to get the domain name and have the domain name transferred to you. The most interesting thing about this is what most of us would consider bad faith, which is that you went and registered the mark and have nothing to do with it, and then you call up Apple.com and try to extort money out of them and say, listen, I know you want it and I'll give it to you for $2 million. Is not the kind of bad faith that the statute has been interpreted to prohibit. Things that are far broader than that kind of bad faith have been interpreted to come under the cyber squatting statute. And we can talk more about that if people are interested. I'll just mention one that you might have heard of, which is that the World Wrestling Federation won an arbitration case against a guy who had registered worldwrestlingfederation.com. He wasn't trying to screw the WWF, but he had registered this name, and they won the arbitration and got the name back from him. There's also a dispute resolution process that ICANN has instituted, and I put the URL up for the explanation of that process.
Question: How does this affect things like, you know, obviously the corporate name, or you know, like politician running like G.W. Bush, GeorgeBush.com, .net, you know, they're out there registering all these other things. They're trying to cite this also to get domain names for people that have registered things like georgebushsucks.com.net.org. How can they say they have a right to George Bush Sucks or Verizon is a ripoff.com, whatever titles that other people have registered?
Absolutely. This trademark thing comes up a lot when we're talking about either fan sites or roasting sites where you're criticizing somebody, and George Bush Sucks, or just recently the Democrats registered BushCheney.org, I think it is, and put up a lot of stuff about Cheney and how he's too conservative for America and all of that. And how can they claim that? Do they own every domain name that has the word Bush in it? What are they thinking? Well, this has sort of been a back and forth, and I at one of the last conferences conferences I was at, I met the guy who had registered gwbush.com, who seems to be an avowed Democrat. And the way they went after him was not trademark. The way they went after him was they used the Federal Elections Commission and said, well, he registered the name, but it was he was actually sort of advocating against George Bush, so he should have been registered it should be registered as part of the donations or campaign contributions. Thank you. Yeah, registered as a campaign contribution to the other side because he's lobbying really against G.W. Bush. And out of that dispute came really just one of the most beautiful quotes from Governor Bush that I've heard, which is when they asked him, you know, don't you think the kid has a free speech right to put what he wants to put on the site, and how can you call down the Elections Commission on him? And Governor Bush said, there ought to be limits to freedom. So they ought to think about that a little bit. So there's lots of ways. Trademark's not the only one. The trademark's not the only one. Now I'm going to have to register with the FEC. Okay, so I'm moving on to obscenity. There's the Miller test. I used to know it when I saw it, but now I have the Miller test to tell me what it is. That's obscenity. And child pornography is something that uses an actual child in a sexually suggestive way. Both obscenity and child pornography are not protected speech. There's no First Amendment protection for these things, so it's like out in the wilderness. The obscenity provisions of the CDA are still in effect and still apply because First Amendment doesn't apply to that type of those types of things. Virtual child porn is something which is not in which a real child was not used to make it, but in which it looks like or is suggestive of child pornography. Those child pornography statutes are right now sort of on hold. There's a split in the circuits as to whether that's a violation of the First Amendment. The whole thing about child pornography is it hurts a real child in the production of it. With virtual child porn, no real children are harmed in the making of this item. It's merely looks bad. So there's First Amendment issues there, and we don't know. Basically, to sum up about obscenity and child pornography, you have some options, but if you permit the uploading or downloading, if your system permits the uploading or downloading of illegal materials, then in order for the system provider to have any kind of criminal or civil responsibility, it must have knowledge of the nature and the character of the materials. Without actual knowledge of the nature and the character of materials, there's going to be no criminal liability. You don't have to know it's a minor, but you have to know it. You have to know what it's... You have to know it's a minor? But you have to know it's obscene. But you don't have to know it's obscene.
You don't have to know the legal.
Okay, Mark tells me you have to know it's a minor, which is good to know, very important. And now what about if you put indecent materials, or if your site allows indecent materials to be in a realm where children have access? Because the CDA and CDA2, which is the Child Online Protection Act, are now, there's an injunction, and one's been overturned by the Supreme Court, the other there's an injunction against. Those are not operating, so indecent material, which is sexually suggestive or suggestive in other ways, but is still receives some First Amendment protection, you're not going to get in trouble for that, probably. Do you have a question? He asked me whether being deliberately unaware gives you any sort of liability, and I would say deliberate unawareness can be your best friend. So, I mean, most of the statutes were passed because the prior court rulings had punished people who tried to be aware. That's what happened with Prodigy in the Stratton Oakmont case. And so it encouraged ISPs to just turn a blind eye to everything. So most of these statutes are trying to encourage or give a sort of immunity for companies that have some sort of civic responsibility in monitoring what's going across their networks. But if you don't know, it can't hurt you. What about permitting access to third-party sites where illegal materials are stored? There's a specific defense to this in the CDA, which is still operant. It's at 47 U.S.C. 223E1, which says that if you make a good faith effort to restrict access to minors, or if you link to a third-party site where there's indecent or obscene material, there's no liability. Okay, final one, please. And then finally, upstream liability. Many people talk about using the criminal law to make computer systems more secure. I'm a big believer that the criminal law is a blunt tool in this field. I think one of the better ways to encourage general health and safety of the network is through our tort law. And we have not seen many cases of this, but in the recent distributed denial of service attacks, what we saw is weak systems that were used to break into other systems with which they had a trusted relationship. So we will see, as time goes on, a standard for keeping your system secure develop, and then companies that fall short of this standard and are negligent in maintaining the security of their system will be sued by people who were hacked as a result. Why is that? Because you can't sue the hacker because maybe he's like a 15-year-old with no money, or maybe he's not going to ever be caught, but you can sue the system that you broke in through, and that's what I think we're going to start seeing happen. The issues with that are basically, how are we going to set the standard of due diligence, and how are small companies that don't have a lot of resources going to comply with keeping up with everything they need to keep up with to make sure that their system has a state-of-the-art security. There was a case where a Scottish ISP sued Nike because Nike's system was insecure, and as a result, the Scottish ISP suffered some. I have the URL up there, but when I went to look at it yesterday to refresh my memory about the details of the case, the story was not there, so I'm not sure exactly what that's about. If anybody knows anyone from Excite, we can corner them and find out what happened to the FirstNet only versus Nike case. But that's the first one that I've seen published in the paper, and I think we're definitely going to be seeing more and more of those. So with that, we have about 7 minutes left for questioning, and I would invite you guys to ask either Mark or I questions about either what we've talked about today or crime, our first true love. In the back? Thank you to this gentleman.
I believe in Britain they passed a law where, particularly for encryption keys, they can send somebody to prison for quite a long time for refusing to produce encryption keys. But in particularly like subpoenas with warrants or whatnot, the government's collecting information, how can they compel somebody, and what are the ramifications that person is able to refuse to
Is the question about the UK? Because it's my understanding that the RIP bill, as it's called, has not actually been passed yet. Or are you talking about within the US?
They were proposing. I was just saying, what's the analog in the United States?
Okay. We have this thing you may have heard of called the Fifth Amendment. There's a lot of interesting thinking on this. A colleague of mine named Phil Reitinger wrote a piece in the University of Chicago Legal Forum back in 96. Around the same time, I published a column in NetGuide, and we actually came to slightly different conclusions about what the right answer is. Certainly, if the... Let's say your passphrase, your PGP passphrase, is strictly in your head. The Fifth Amendment, I would say, would bar me from compelling you. I could give you a grand jury subpoena, but your assertion of the Fifth Amendment as against that compulsion would give you, a right not to comply, and you could not be held in contempt for that noncompliance. If, however, you've written it down, or if you've stored it electronically on a floppy disk or a post-it note, whatever it is, Fifth Amendment production immunity for physical stuff is much the protection itself is much less stringent. It is much easier to compel people to produce things that are pre-existing, if you will, that exist in a physical form, as opposed to requiring the person to use their mental faculties to provide testimony against themselves.
You have a different thought on that?
Okay, does that answer your question? And there, it's kind of involved, because even with things that are actually in printed form, there are some rules. I don't mean to imply that there's no immunity, but it's a...
It's a fairly involved doctrine. The Supreme Court just issued an opinion a couple of months ago in the Webster-Hubbell case, where they somewhat expanded the reach of the production immunity doctrine, but it's still fairly unsettled.
You?
Sorry. I'm Scott Parker, Security Network Consulting. We were talking about corporations and pretty much ignorance is bliss. If you don't know that you've got child pornography on your web, on your servers, that's okay. If you don't know that you've got hackers coming in and stealing data from other corporations, like partner corporations, etc., that's okay. But then on the same flip side,
well, let's just
do due diligence for protecting your company's assets. So is that where we're talking about the standards are not clearly defined on due diligence?
I think there's a difference between not having knowledge of illegal materials on the network, like obscenity or copyrighted materials, and not taking steps to protect the network. Because in one situation, under the civil law, a negligence, you can be sued for negligence, and a negligence standard would apply, meaning that you have to have due diligence. That doesn't apply in the, for example, in the criminal context, because many of the statutes will require actual knowledge. So we're sort of talking about two separate ways of getting in trouble. But where we're talking about civil cases where you can be sued for negligence, you're absolutely right. Dropping the ball is not good. But if we're talking about criminal or even some civil suits for copyright infringement or that kind of thing, and in some of those cases, not knowing is your better bet.
Any indication where those standards might come from?
What do you mean by where?
I think
we're going to start seeing due diligence coming from industry groups. It's not something that the government can set up, but I think that we're going to start having more and more of industry groups or trade groups who are establishing certain standards. Once a cert advisory goes out, you have 30 days to implement the recommended fix. Once something like that, and there'll be sort of a general as computer security develops. I think we're going to see I think we're going to see more and more of a consensus among the experts about what exactly is enough.
I think it's worth, can I just add something to that too? There's a lot of case law on this. I mean, the whole idea of negligence is really kind of squishy. There's some fairly important case law going back to the 20s. I think it was the case of the T.J. Hooper. It was a boat. The court said that an entire industry may have lagged. I think this was one where boats were being sent out on open seas without radios. Actually, this is referenced, those of you who are familiar with the Cheswick and Bellevin Firewalls book, there's a brief discussion of this. I think it's chapter 7, the legal ramifications chapter. So industry-wide practices are not always in and of themselves held to be a good measure of what is not negligent. The courts have said if the industry-wide practice sucks across the board, then you know the fact that you are no worse off than everybody else will not necessarily shield you from civil liability. Yeah, there's something in the law called the Hand Formula. It was articulated by Judge Learned Hand, and it's basically that. It's sort of the cost-benefit analysis.
I believe it was about 2 or 3 months ago.
I was just telling him your name.
It was about 2 or 3 months ago that there was a posting to slash.org, which happens to run a publicly accessible and credible forum, where
the Microsoft stated
a document that was copyrighted by the Microsoft Corporation. And I was wondering what kind of responsibilities the slash.org have to a company like Microsoft. If they're warned, do they have to take that posting down and have people with that person's access? What are their responsibilities?
The question was about the responsibilities or legal duties of Slashdot when they are notified that infringing copyright material owned by Microsoft is on their network. And the safest thing to do is once they are given notice of it is to take it down. The question is, are they going to be liable for contributory copyright infringement under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act because they are given notice but they don't take the steps to take it off? And I think that is going to depend a lot upon whether Slashdot has complied with the safe harbor provisions that the DMCA sets up. So I need more facts to know the answer to that, but DMCA is going to apply to that, and we need to know whether Slashdot's going to come in under any of those statutory immunities. Excellent question.
I think Jennifer was going to ask that question if somebody else didn't. Well, I suppose I would take issue with the characterization of it as a mass email gathering tool. I don't know how many of you actually watched the testimony on Monday, but that is in fact, well, at least one person here besides me, but that is in fact not what the system is designed or intended to do. It operates entirely within the legal authorities that I just described. So it must be targeted at, say, an account, say a particular port, say communication coming in from a particular, let's say, Class C block, maybe from a Class C block to a particular port, but it is used only to gather those communications which are within the scope of the court order, so you have to have court authorization to use the system.
I'd like to respond to that, if I may. And this is, if you wanted to get me and Mark to fight.
Look at the time.
If you wanted to get me and Mark to fight, you did a good job. The thing about Carnivore that's different from what we have had the wiretap statutes regulating before is that in the wiretap statutes we have a minimization requirement, which means that they can't listen to grandma's conversation with Johnny about the cookies. And one of the reasons why that happened is because that's what the law says. The other reason why it happened is because it's too much work to listen to every single conversation of every single person. So not only were there legal limits, but there were practical limits as well. And what Carnivore does is it kills the practical limitations. So now all we have is the legal limitations. And everyone in here knows that when you pass a law, it doesn't stop people from doing the bad thing. If it did, I wouldn't have a job. So here we have a law that's supposed to stop people, the FBI, from doing the bad thing, which is surveilling all our communications over the internet, and that's supposed to be enough for us. What the technology does is it destroys the thing that really stopped them from listening to everything, which is that it just simply wasn't cost effective. And now all we have is some words in a book.
I guess one response I have to that is it's hard for a monitoring system to listen to everything if it's not deployed widely or even at all. I think the testimony on Monday was that the system in question has been deployed pursuant to court order 16 times. It's not like this is something sitting on the border routers of all, this is not installed at May East and May West. So we're not talking about the big vacuum in the sky.
In the interest of letting us all ask other questions, I'm going to let Mark have the last word on that, which is completely against my inclination, and I'm going to go on to some other questions, and then if we want to argue about Carnivore more later, we can. Sir?
A lot of the stuff that you were talking about earlier with the disclosure information and stuff like that seemed to be discussed in an ideal scenario, like without the human factor. People make mistakes. What processes exist if, for example, the ISP sends the wrong person some email or judgmental information? Does the individual who had all their email or their data submitted ever get told that they had all their information disclosed wrongly? And also, where information is coming into a mailbox?
I think there are a lot of parts to this, so let me see if I can answer it. You're saying, suppose I serve a warrant on AOL, let's say, for John Doe's email sitting on the mail server. Actually, AOL is sort of a bad example, but let's use it anyway. And they produced to me Jane Doe's information instead. AOL in that case would have violated the statute, is subject to civil remedies under the law. However, they are not required, and the government is not required under the statute to give notice to the user.
Now, if there is a preclusion of notice provision in the statute, that's something that can be undone by the court. And I suppose the issuing court could, in fact, even go further and require that the disclosure be made thereafter to the subscriber. I can only think of one case where that's come up, and this actually was one that got litigated. It was the it was an Air Force case, Maxwell. It's about 4 years old. It was one of these things where you had a numeral one versus lowercase l confusion. And in that case, it was on the part of AOL. I'm not sure what the issue was, whatever came of it for the person who was the innocent third party. I'm not aware how it came out, but there's a published court opinion on that, so it's certainly public that there was a mistake made there by the provider. I think we need to cut it short at this point, just so we can get to lunch. But I will be around for the rest of the day if you guys want to come up and buttonhole me, and I think Jennifer will be too.
I'll be here till Sunday morning, so I want to thank you all for coming, and feel free to engage us in argument.